Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Benedictine abbot Timothy Wright reflects on one resurrection gift, especially for those who are sensitive to it, which is the role of women. We hear about the Alpha Programme, what it is and what it does. Film critic Peter Malone gives us a foretaste of three very different biographies with lots of interesting facts and figures. But first we listen to the words of Pope Benedict XVI, who recited the Regina Caeli prayer in St. Peter's Square, together with the many faithful who were there to be with him. Lydia O'Kane tells us more.
Pope Benedict's visit to the Holy Land next week was at the heart of his Regina Caeli address from St. Peter's Square on Sunday. He said he was going there as a pilgrim of peace in the name of the one God who is Father to everyone. I will bear witness, he added, to the commitment of the Catholic Church in promoting dialogue and reconciliation in order to bring about a stable and lasting peace with justice and reciprocal respect.
This Friday, I leave for my pilgrimage to the Holy Land, where men and women first heard the voice of the Good Shepherd. I ask you all to join me in praying for the afflicted peoples of that region. In a special way, I ask that you remember the Palestinian people who have endured great hardship and suffering. May the Lord bless them and all those who live in the Holy Land with the gifts of unity and peace.
As well as asking for prayers for the Palestinians, the Pope also asked that everyone would remember the people of Mexico and many others in the world who have either died or been made sick by a new viral flu epidemic. During his address, the Holy Father noted that this Sunday was the World Day of Prayer for Vocations, so it seemed fitting that earlier in the day Pope Benedict should ordain 19 priests for the Diocese of Rome in the grand surroundings of St. Peter's Basilica.
Figli carissimi, prima di ricevere l'ordine del presbiterato, dovete manifestare davanti al popolo di Dio la volontà di assumerne gli impegni.
In his homily, the Pope spoke of the priest as someone who remains with Christ. And making a comparison between the priest and the good shepherd, he said, the shepherd offers his life for all sheep. Each and every priest is the personal recipient of Christ's prayer and of his same sacrifice.
Perciò il discepolo, specialmente l'apostolo, sperimenta la stessa gioia di Gesù, di conoscere il nome e il volto del Padre. E condivide anche il suo dolore.
It is true, continued the Pope, and we priests experience this. To become priests in the Church, said Pope Benedict, means to give oneself to Christ through the sacrament of ordination, giving yourself with all of your being. Finally, the Holy Father wished all those being ordained that the Holy Spirit would impress the divine word in their hearts so as to bear abundant and lasting fruit.
Thanks to Lydia O'Kane for that report. Picking up on the current liturgical theme of the resurrection, Benedictine abbot Timothy Wright reflects on one of its gifts, on what is perhaps one of its most significant features for those who are sensitive to it, which is the role of the women, and particularly that of Mary Magdalene.
You would think that after 3 years, with all the ups and downs with his 12 closest disciples and numerous other friends who were helping on the sidelines, mainly men, that the first people to go and look at the tomb would be one of them. Not at all. It was Mary Magdalene, from whom 7 devils had been cast out. Now, I don't know what your image of a woman possessed by 7 devils is, but it speaks to me of a level of corruption whereby the femininity, the sensitivity, the ability to relate effectively, incisively, has been at least somewhat impaired, if not largely destroyed, by these seven devils. Here is a woman who has been so infected by the other, the evil other, that her life is publicly known as sinner. And as Jesus said, he or she who has been given much is loved much. And it is not at all surprising that this woman was the first to go and seek the one she had lost. The mutual love of Jesus for Mary Magdalene is a rich store of how human love can be transformed and enlarged when it is linked to a spiritual, or if you like, an incarnational, and more so a resurrection dimension. And Mary Magdalene occupies that pole position in the whole Christian story. She went to the tomb, expecting to do her duty with regard to the corpse of Jesus, the one who had cured her, the one to whom she owed so much, and for whom there was, and with whom there was, such mutual, deep mutual love. And in that encounter, we see one of the most important elements of the resurrection truth, that our love as human beings, with its tendency to hold, its tendency to be exclusive, is now being challenged by the love that is bigger than possession, any human possession, and is more active than anything would want to be exclusive. It has none of the limitations of exclusiveness. And Mary Magdalene recognizes that, but she has to make the journey. She didn't recognize that the gardener was Jesus, the risen Jesus, because she was looking for someone different. But because she was open to receive, she just didn't walk away. She was able to listen. And in that listening, she perceived it was not the gardener, it was the risen Jesus. And the risen Jesus coming to that woman to whom he has given so much, that encounter is of huge importance in the resurrection scene. But also, we see that behind the story on that Easter Monday, we have automatically the male world coming in, the deceit. The guards go off to the Jewish authorities, and the Jewish authorities give them the story, the spin. One of them came and collected the body. How appalling. And then we have the other theme of so important in this, is that the women are always at the tomb, at the presence. And it is part of the truth that we hold that their role in the resurrection as witness, as one who owes so much to the limitation of life, who are there at the point of suffering, as they were at the foot of the cross, are now also there at the moment of hope. And how often we find in life that it is the women who offer the care, the support, the affirmation when we're in difficulty. How much easier they find it to sympathize, to cheer up. And that is something that in the resurrection world is of huge importance. The disciples were dejected. Who came to tell them? The women. The disciples didn't quite know what to make of it. But the women were secure in the knowledge that they had met the risen Jesus. And this is acknowledged in the Emmaus story, where the two disciples to their companion say, "And two of our women are reported that the grave was empty, are reported to have seen the risen Lord." And again, during that week, the return in another version to Mary Magdalene, the one who found the empty tomb. So these little thoughts should encourage all of us, particularly the women among us who feel that they are exploited, that their lives are crushed by the men in their lives, that there is a man who will transform their lives, who has done so and will go on doing so in a way that no human man could ever do. And then to the men listening who are anxious about their wives, their daughters, their grandmothers, or their mothers, who are a little uncertain about the way they treat women, whether they exploit, how they exploit them, they're not thankful, they're not appreciative. These are all signs of the need for that resurrection gift. Because the one thing that Jesus did for Mary Magdalene was to affirm that he was alive, to affirm that he still loved her, to affirm that she would be benefiting from this resurrection in a way she could not possibly understand. And finally, that the forgiveness that she was offered is a forgiveness which is expanded, continues, until the moment where the gift of love in the dimensions of resurrection reaches not just to the core of every woman's life and every man's life, but to the vision of a community in which this life overpowers the individualism, the personality, the divisiveness that so often marks and injures family, community, nation, the world community. Indeed, affirming the role of women in this particular apostolate is something that should be part of our prayer in this resurrection period, as a time when the gift first came to women, because women would receive it more easily and use it more effectively than the men. That was Jesus' decision. It's ours to give thanks for. Amen.
You've been listening to Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright. And turning to something quite different, do you know what the Alpha program is? I didn't, until I came across an interview with Vicar Nicky Gumbel, a former barrister turned Anglican priest who was in Rome to promote it. Vicar Gumbel actually came to Vatican Radio and explained that it is really very simple, and that's part of its appeal and why it has become so popular the world over. The Alpha course, I discovered, is a 10-week practical introduction to the Christian faith. It's a flexible and practical model that can work for a group of any size. Churches and Christian organizations of every background and denomination are discovering it to be a simple and effective way of presenting the gospel of Jesus Christ to people of all walks of life. Vicar Gumbel explained how it all began.
Alpha came out of a local church. I'm the vicar of a local church in London. And 20 years ago, I started to get involved in Alpha. And Alpha is really something that is designed for people outside of the church. And we started to run this course that was designed for people who don't go to church, people who wouldn't call themselves Christians. And we found we were getting hundreds of people coming on each course.
Vicar Gumbel says that he is often credited as being the founder of Alpha, but that's not really true.
The course started in 1977 with someone called Charles Marnham, and it was then a four-week course for people who were already Christians, and various people developed it, and I took it on in 1990. And the slight change I made was to make it a course for people outside of the church. And because in England there are so many more people outside of the church than inside of the church, the numbers really started to take off at that point.
Why is it called Alpha?
Well, Alpha is the beginning. It's the first letter, as you know, of the Greek alphabet, and the course is really a beginning. So it's what unites all Christians. It's all about Jesus, what he did for us, the Holy Spirit, the church, things that all Christians are united about. And so for people outside of the church, we start with what unites us. And as Father Raniero Cantalamessa has often said, what unites us is infinitely greater than what divides us. So we start with Jesus.
And how did Alpha enter the Catholic Church?
In 1996, Cardinal Hume invited us to do a conference for Catholic priests and laity who were interested in running the course. And we were so packed out, we had to do another conference. And that one was so full, we had to do another one. And then the Catholic priests and lay people went back to their parishes and started to run the course. And since then, it spread. Alpha has spread throughout the world now to 160 countries in 99 languages. Over 10 million people have done the course in 36,000 churches around the world.
What happens during the course? How is it structured?
What happens is people come for a meal. They have a talk, or the subject could be Jesus, or why did Jesus die, or faith, or the Bible, or prayer. Then they have coffee, and then small groups. And the small groups would be about 10 to 12 people, most of whom are people from outside of the church, where they discuss, where they explore the issues together.
Have many people been baptised after following an Alpha course?
Many, many people, yes. 10 million people have done the course. And I would think now hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, have been baptised after doing the course.
It sounds as though Alpha may also have an ecumenical value as well.
Alpha is running in the Roman Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, the Methodist, Baptist, Lutheran, all the different churches around the world. And we find that by doing something together, that this is very effective for people outside of the church. Jesus prayed that we would be one, in order that the world will believe. And we find that coming together to evangelize has the effect of drawing people together in unity. And because in a town in England, you know, any town in England, you'll find Catholic churches, Anglican churches, Methodist churches, Lutheran churches, all running the same course. That is a very effective sign for people outside of the church. They want to know, what is it that we're all agreed about? And we find the average age of the people who come on the course in our church is 27. 75% of the people coming up age between 18 and 35. And there's this huge spiritual hunger.
Earlier, Vicar Gumbel mentioned the course as a response to a wide-ranging spiritual need.
I think there's a great spiritual hunger. People want to know the answer to questions like, what is the meaning of life? What's the purpose of my life? What happens when I die? What about forgiveness? Is forgiveness possible? I think people want answers to these questions, but sometimes they're not ready to go to church. They need some kind of bridge, some way in which they can explore these issues in a way that is low-key, unthreatening, non-confrontational. And Alpha provides that relaxed environment where people can explore these questions, find a relationship with God through Jesus Christ, find that hunger met, that spiritual hunger met. Then they become excited about their faith, about Jesus. They say to their friends, come and see. And hopefully those friends come on the next course.
The Alpha program, Vicar Gumbel says, is not only a challenge for the individual, it's a challenge for the parish as well.
New life presents a challenge to any church. It presents a challenge to us, because we have, as I say, the average age is 27 of the people coming on the course. They're young people with no church experience, and we have to look at what we do on a Sunday to make sure that it's welcoming to people who are outside of the church. So it's had a good effect on us as a community as well. We've had to learn to adapt to make sure that we present the message on Sunday in a way that is accessible to people outside of the church, so that they can be integrated into the body of Christ and grow in their faith in Jesus Christ.
So, the bottom line is that Alpha brings the participant back to the basic relationship with Jesus Christ. It helps create a sense of community, a place where people are called by their first names. It's a clear and simple presentation of the good news and opens the doors to a living faith in a society that is hungry for spiritual nourishment. Now we go over to our friend, film critic Peter Malone, who heads the film office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. After having given us The Creeps last week with two thrillers, today he gives us a foretaste of three very different biographies with lots of interesting facts and figures. Okay, so on to the biography genre. You are really a man of many facets and surprises. This film, I would really like to go and see. It's about the early adult years of the poet Federico Garcia Lorca and his friendship with Salvador Dalí and Luis Buñuel.
Morality, immorality, good, bad, we have to smash that to pieces.
It was a surprising film. I saw it at a mini festival and wasn't expecting it to get too much release, but it looks as though it is going to get a more widespread release. It's obviously very interesting if you want to go back into that kind of aspect of last century Spanish history.
Can't stay here much longer, Federico.
These people know who you are. What you've been saying about Franco, they know everything.
What surprised me is that the dialogue is actually in English as well, which is it's nice for the English audiences to be able to watch without having the subtitles.
Oh, yes. It was made by a Welsh psychologist filmmaker who made Solomon and Gaynor a couple of years ago, a lovely film set in Wales, in Welsh, which got an Oscar nomination for Best Foreign Language. And he made another film called Wondrous Oblivion, which was actually about cricket in London in the past. So he's an interesting filmmaker, but what attracted him to Lorca, I don't know. The focus is on Garcia Lorca himself, and to that extent, I found it very interesting in terms of his life, the politics of the time,
right.
His involvement in the Civil War eventually, and his arrest and execution.
Is there any footage, original footage in the film? I know the Madrid in the early 1920s and the revolution. Is that touched on at all?
Vive la revolution!
I'm going to Paris.
Yes, they've done quite a good recreation of the period, and when they were there, they were in their 20s as well. So they're young students, which is where Lorca met up with Salvador Dali, and Buñuel is there in the background. One of the interesting things which might actually have motivated the filmmakers to distribute it is that Dali is played by an English actor called Robert Pattinson.
Oh, the young actor who was in Harry Potter.
The young actor who's in Harry Potter.
Right.
But you need to check, it won't be the response of a lot of the young ladies who actually see the advertisement, because he's the star of Twilight.
Ah.
He's the vampire.
Okay.
And it sold 6 million DVD and Blu-ray copies in the US on its release. So Robert Pattinson is now very popular. But with his accent, and you mightn't recognise him, and then eventually with his moustache, he makes Dali a very interesting, complex, and probably unlikable character.
Just reading your review, I discovered that Garcia Lorca becomes aware of his sexual orientation and his love for Salvador Dali. I had no idea of this. I've read so many of Garcia Lorca's love poems.
I think of you, and everything I am has been split apart.
Yes, and the thing I noticed in some notes is that Dali was very much in denial about this relationship, this affection, and it was probably only later in his life that there was some acknowledgement of it.
Gala is in the film as well, isn't she? Dali's wife.
Yes.
Fascinating wife.
She is, yes. Because coming back to Spain after some time in France, they reunite, but they don't actually take the strong stance against the fascist regime as García Lorca does, and he returns back home to his peasant village, and that's where he's arrested.
So, a nice historically based film to go and see, something I'd enjoy for sure, which brings us to two other biographies you mentioned, Flash of Genius and The Damned United.
Yes, I just mentioned those along with to say that there's always an interest in biographical films. And The Damned United was all news to me because I don't understand English football, or what we would call soccer. But Michael Sheen is one of the reasons for mentioning it, because we've seen him as Tony Blair in The Queen. We saw him as David Frost in Frost Nixon. And now he's the manager of Leeds United in the 1970s.
I think you're the best young manager in this country.
Thank you. I'm the best old one too.
Fairly arrogant, although talented, and we see his rise and his downfall. And it makes for an interesting film. Not all that many football scenes, but a lot of the atmosphere of the period and English spirit.
Football is a beautiful game. It needs to be played beautifully.
I thought it was worth a mention. And the same with The Flash of Genius, which is about, well, if I say it's about the man who invented the windscreen wipers that actually pours so that they can actually wipe water away from the windshield, as they say.
Intermittent
is the, right. Yes, is the phrase.
Hey, Dad, Mom wants to know where the blender is.
It's down here. He's taking it apart.
But where that's interesting is that Greg Kinnear, who's a very sympathetic actor, is the inventor, and his patent is actually stolen by Ford, and this is actual
story. Is
this
a true story?
It is.
There's 20 million cars built in this country, and every one of them's going to need our wiper.
They want out, Bob.
Who wants out?
Ford.
Out? They have the unit.
I know. I know.
And so he sued them, but it took 12 years of his life. He became absolutely obsessed, and it had repercussions on his marriage and with his family. And while he wins in the end, which I suppose we know that that's going to happen, David and Goliath, right, as everybody says, you wonder whether it's worth it.
Suing one of the most powerful corporations in the world, that's something you take on lightly.
A lot of people have said, yes, in his fight, he protected a whole lot of inventors for the future. But at what personal cost is certainly the question that comes out of the film.
An interesting sounding film that is.
I should mention Flash of Genius, by the way, is in the legislation about patents in 1941. You have to prove that you actually had some time or moment when you had the intuition which led to your invention.
Invention.
And that's called the Flash of Genius.
So the invention in itself is not enough.
No, no, you've got to prove that it's yours.
Ford wants to offer your family $30 million.
Do they admit it was my invention?
No.
Don't do it, Dad.
You could walk away with nothing. I do know
where you go. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.